I was working on my laptop with some wireless signal, but it went all belly up on me, so I reconnected on my telephone and my desktop.
There you go.
Yeah.
So Jamie, whether they called it soul or energy, it would still be point. It would still be just this anyway, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I would say so. Yeah, a lot of philosophizing in those readings.
We're philosophizing?
We were.
Oh, we were, pretty.
Yeah, you know, I was just filling in some gaps there with Buddhist versus, you know, Vedic type stuff regarding self. What little I know about it and learned about it.
Ah, it's great. What fun stuff. Who did somebody come out on top, or did you have a preference?
A preference. I guess I would see it just based on my own experience. Of course, you know, there could be amnesia involved, but the way I see it, the Buddhist thing makes a little more sense, which is just like there's this energy that may continue on and may go into whatever, you know, but the Hindu Vedic approach seems to be on reincarnation, and it's like you have the origins, let's call it, a personality that sort of glom onto a new body. So I don't know. It just seems a little creative and constructionist or whatever.
Yeah. The Buddhists have the reincarnation thing going too, right?
Some of them, I think.
Yeah, I think that some of them just can't help but, like, get into that. I don't know for... But I think it sounds to me like what the Buddha was talking about was,
yeah.
It's not that. It's just rebirth, possibly, but it's not you that's being reborn.
I mean, didn't he have in his in the myth? Didn't he have all kinds of memories of being in other lives? Or
I have no idea about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was clear. It's pretty clear in the literature that one of the telltale signs of, you know, Buddhahood or something like it is clear memory or recall of all past lives.
But apparently, the Zen Buddhists don't believe in reincarnation.
Yeah, because nobody wants to sit ever again.
But. I guess if you wake up from a dream, it's all a dream, so maybe it becomes moot and therefore not, doesn't factor in importantly.
Yeah, I think that that might be a more sobering view. But, you know, even Ramakrishna was quoted as saying, "He who was Rama and he who was Krishna is now together in this body, this incarnation, as Ramakrishna."
Hmm.
But we don't know if he was referring to the past lives of other, what are they called? Avatars.
Avatars, yeah.
And, yeah, we don't know if he was referring to himself as the legitimate reincarnation of prior avatars, or whether he was speaking from a more absolute point of view. I think he may have been maybe speaking from both points of view to satisfy his audiences, his dualism audience and his non-dualism audience. So he had them both coming and going.
Wow. covering all the bases. It's like praying to all the different gods.
Yeah, I mean, what he brought to the table is kind of a claim to fame was the revelation that all religions, all the world's religions, were about the same thing, all pointed, aimed at the same liberated destination.
Find all of the Abrahamic religions. Externalize the whole thing, it seems, you know.
Yeah. And that was a, you know, at that time, that was a big move. A great Hindu Sanatan Dharma embrace. That all the world's religions were of the same, made of the same stuff.
Yeah.
You know, if your mind doesn't move, if for some reason we find a momentary cessation of any kind of manufacture, then there's release. It's only the tweeting and twittering, pun intended,
yeah,
of a mind moving through the vast labyrinthine possibilities of reference making that makes it appear as if something is happening or happened or needs to be described in generous spiritual or religious tones.
I'm always confused when we talk about mind, because I don't really know what it is. It seems to encompass so much and has so many different meanings.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Buddha mind is bodhicitta, and yeah, using the mind in a more pedestrian manner refers to thinking and thought and identification and accusation.
And maybe consciousness, or consciousness underlies mind, maybe. That's a better way to put it.
Well, it sure is funny to look at the full vocabulary of lovely words that are used to refer to irrefutable subjectivity. And then blame it on consciousness, or blame it on the bossa nova. Blame it on Buddha mind, or, you know, a good warm plate of vegetable fried rice with honeyed shrimp.
Here, 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 here.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, so is that irrefutability is present, is maybe a secular way of referring to the miracle of experiencing, the miracle of consciousness, the miracle of the absolute. Because consciousness doesn't mean anything. Neither does the absolute. Neither does bodhicitta.
Neither does fried rice.
Fried rice, yogurt, low-calorie yogurt, coconut bars.
Republicans?
Thank God it has nothing to do with Republicans. Well, we're tortured by restlessness, tortured by, you know, the myth of individuation, and tortured by vulnerability of all kinds. Simply because we misapprehend or misunderstand the nature of experiencing, that it doesn't actually convey agency, that it, that experiencing is not the consequence of the body, but that what we call or refer to as the miracle of body-mind are exfoliations of consciousness, exfoliations of the primacy of being.
On that note, I'll offer up one of my favorite old Shakyamuni wizard quotes.
Oh, those are fun.
In which he said, "If it wasn't for this, unborn, unmade, unformed, which are epithets for nirvana, then escape from the world of the born, the made, the formed, which are epithets for samsara, would not be possible."
Yeah.
Would not be possible.
Yeah.
He just nailed it. So it's like, okay, well, chew on that for a while.
I mean, the notion of the unborn, or the, you know, miraculous and agency-free presence, is responsible for samsara. It's like samsara doesn't have any independent agency like the Abrahamic or Christian myth would like you to believe, that there's a divine persona as God, and then, you know, the divine villain such as Beelzebub.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, sitting right here with no effort at all, there's just space. Awareness has no content. Mind might be present, subtly or otherwise, but it's not conjuring any certainty.
Well, it's not giving birth to anything.
Not giving birth. And so, isn't it strange that just here, just now, with no peculiar effort or particular effort, is the revelation of awake?
Autonomously.
Now, we tend to, you know, as card-carrying seekers, most of us with, you know, seeker PhDs, can whip up a storyline or a cause-effect puzzle easily.
Well, certainly possible.
Happens all the time.
You think we do it out of boredom sometimes, because we when you talk about the present moment like that, it's just obvious how beautiful it is. So it's like, why wouldn't we stay there all the time, you know? But then all of a sudden we're in story again.
Yes, right. Marvelous.
Actually, it's wonderful until I think this is wonderful. Then a little of it is gone.
Well, sure. That's right. Yeah, the slightest icing on the cake.
Like when you see a sunset and you go, this is, oh my God, it's beautiful. Right there in that second, you just lost some of the beauty, you know?
Yeah, sure. It could be framed like that. Right. The training, if we could call it that, for the left-hand path, whether the left-hand path is coming down a Dzogchen pike or a Yoga of Radiant Presence avenue or the bird path of Siddharameshwar, is this very, very simple and non-remarkable observation. That this is deliciously quiet.
You know, what you said with the idea that let's take the typical, you know, symbology of the sunset, and you say, isn't that beautiful? But I think all that's fine, but then you start to reflect on, you just haven't said, isn't this beautiful? And that's what starts the thing rolling. You know, the reflection on it, and then not only the reflection, but sort of the lashing back at having thought that.
Yeah, any, you know, the slightest seduction into meaning creation is kind of like a tar baby or flypaper.
That's, you know, right.
Once you have the slightest little bit of adhesion,
yeah,
you can't shake it off.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's a nice metaphor, because the call it the yoga, or the root of inquiry, is to see how miraculously we become adhered to a thought stream, a belief, a restlessness, an accomplishment, a rumination, an entertainment. But we can also discover that it is actually effortless to put it down.
Hmm.
To shake off the flypaper.
Maybe, and it's all the efforting that's creating the...
yes, yes, yes. Any resistance whatsoever furthers the illusion, furthers the delusion. Yeah. So when we learn to put it down, you could say what we're doing is returning to the confidence that this is only silence.
Yeah.
It's not a refusal of anything. It's not a resistance. It's not a pining, right, to be free from affliction. It's your profound capacity for spontaneous intelligence to decouple with no effort from the myth of story creation.
Yeah, the myth of story creation and the myth that effort will get you to the goal, will get you there.
Effort is mortar for the self.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of the other thing I believe that's worth noticing is that there's no way to stop feeling this being as it is. That's not possible.
Yeah, the emphasis is on feeling this as it is.
Correct.
Even with the story. Even if there's a story happening, to feel that too.
Sure.
Because that's the only freedom if you're okay with all of it, right?
I think there must be stages for any of us on a discovery adventure where we become, you know, more refined with respect to the attenuation of awareness. As John points out, feeling this as it is an intimacy with silence, with story-free consciousness, story-free presence. And even if stories do occur and we, let's say, get hooked on them, you know, it's going to come around again that we can become absolutely and spontaneously decoupled.
So is there a point where you just never get stuck to the story? Is that what the, you know, what self-realization looks like at its finish line?
Yeah, right. The apogee of the golden ring. Well, you know, any and all literature that we may read from all these traditions which talk about self-realization in idealized and remarkable tones make it appear as if that is or has been accomplished, what you just suggested, as a permanent pinnacle of disentanglement from story. But I don't even know if that's all that important. It sets up another kind of idealized condition or experience that one might seek to fulfill. So that creates another kind of effort, another kind of resistance even, which is mortar for the self.
So you can't have your story and eat your frozen yogurt bar too, or?
Well, sure, because unless you're sitting in some kind of exotic samadhi where there's, you know, arguably disentanglement and disidentification with body, disidentification with mind, disidentification with world and phenomena, then, you know, you're going to be kind of naturally woven between, call it unencumbered delight, and whatever story feels like showing up when it feels like showing up. Maybe we discover that we more lucidly and effortlessly return or realign with presence, silence, drama-free, unencumbered being, and establish, you could say, greater confidence that that's the home ground. As in, you know, right now. Right now is always better. It's always better than some conjecture about enlightenment as a finality or as an idealized condition. Because right now, we'll kick your ass. And hypothetical notions about a future enlightenment is mortar for the self.
I knew that laugh was coming because a big smile came out. So,
you know, we're trained since conception to be greedy, aren't we? It's valued. So we're greedy for experience, and we're greedy for knowledge, and we're greedy for attention seeking. We're greedy for celebrity, we're greedy for, you know, spiritual success or competitive sports success. We're greedy to make as much or more money than the next guy. We're even greedy in the Buddhist community to be more compassionate than the fellow on the cushion next to me. And greed, like storytelling, like hypothetical imagination, is mortar for the self. And it's gotta put a fucking smile on your face when you're done with greed.
So much for Gordon Gekko, then, I guess.
So much for Gordon Gekko, yeah. Point. Now, I think the attractiveness of the realized soul, you know, six of them on this call, is the complete relinquishment of greed, of necessity, of explanation, of causal links. Here you go. This is awake. Greed-free, unencumbered, profoundly silent, disentangled, awake. It's nice.
You know, I find sometimes when I read or encounter something that we, let's call it a learning, or another perspective or something like that, that can sometimes, oh, I don't know, maybe make more available, or it seems as though it can have an impact.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as long as we're running the story that this moment is insufficient to the task of my liberation, so I might benefit from an enhancement strategy.
Although, is this not right now what we're doing, an enhancement strategy?
Well, it could be an enhancement strategy, or it could just be kind of an enlightenment circle jerk. John's in. It's, you know, it's kind of strange for, let's say, seekers as peers, aspirants as friends, to get together and radiate, ruminate, luxuriate in awake. Play with it, right? Without, you know, without having to prove anything to anybody, without having to have your persona, you know, be magnetically transformed. Why not
for everybody now on the internet?
Why not participate in a culture, even if it's a culture of six, where, oh yeah, this is awake, this is cool, this doesn't suck. And then, you know, you don't have someone sitting on a tucket that's arrived at the lovely idealized condition that Bruce framed so well, and then the rest of us sitting around the tucket going, how do I get it, how do I get it, how do I get it? You know, this is awake. It has always been. It's its only nature. So why do we, you know, persist in vocabulary that insists otherwise? Stop creating yourself as something less than perfectly awake. That was easy. Someone got a Staples button? You know, and if a question or an inquiry, a reflection arises in the midst of hanging out, being awake, well, then that's fantastic. You know, we can all enjoy taking that magic carpet ride with anyone's, you know, question or curiosity or reflection about the present nature of consciousness.
Which will always bring us back to here anyway.
Doesn't it? It's guaranteed.
Like a Disney ride that always brings you back to the beginning of the line.
Sure, to a nice warm churro. Before any kind of remarkable identity arises in your present experience, there's this. There's unencumbered irrefutability of impersonal subjective nature. It's not at the top of the mountain. It's not across the ocean, though it may be. The important discovery is that, oh, my, It's this. It's me. It's the perfect fulfillment of the presence of experiencing itself. No story is created, and no grasping. No presumption or pining for a better condition than this one. If we're mired in thought and association as the primacy of our first-hand experience, then we're going to be naturally very restless, right? We're going to have suffering. We're going to have the inertia of disappointment, of insufficiency. And so if we're smart, we're going to want to remedy that, medicate that, transcend that, make it better. But if we don't create the hallucination of insufficiency, then it's like chutes and ladders. I mean, immediately we're like, oh, wow, here's the irrefutability of being. I don't see anything missing. I don't see anything wrong. I can't seem to place myself in a condition that attempts to convince me that of the insufficiency of this moment. You could say that freedom reveals itself with the effortless and organic drop of becoming, not a solution or a deliverable on the other side of becoming, but that the myth, the impulse of becoming, just ceases.
It seems like it's not exactly disinterest, though. It's just not getting wrapped up in it.
It's beautiful, poignant, unspeakable interest, unspeakable delight. But not resolvable, not to the point where a subject or an object has been created or asserted. I mean, I heard a guy say, this is the yoga of radiant presence. I don't think he was kidding around. Wonderful way or vehicle for feeling yourself just as you are, just as this is, without any kind of assignment, accusation. Your present experience or experiencing is predicament free. Get used to it.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I just go back to feeling this unstoppably being as it is. You know, I could call it the unstoppable effulgence of emptiness.
I'll buy it.
I could call it radiant presence.
Yeah.
It's like there's, when I come to know that there's no way to get ahead of this and no way to leave it behind, then it's like all of a sudden I start feeling more and more. And yet it's not like more is all of a sudden like being manufactured. This is always boundlessly more. more is boundless. So it's not like I'm, all I'm really doing is noticing the ways that I've been trying to feel this less and less through storytelling or whatever other strategies I might try to come up with. It's curious that way.
It sure is fun to feel this and the moreness of it, even though the moreness does not convey volume, quantity, quality, externalization, or internalization.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't come with any of those labels to it at all, certainly. And it's like it's actually inexhaustible.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's weird that we can hang out, use, you know, our language from birth that we're comfortable with, and walk right into the face of present infinity.
It's absolutely amazing.
And I, you know, looking at or feeling this infinity, I, at least in my experience, what little I have with all this stuff, is kind of like the revelation that this can't be the consequence of body. It can't be the consequence of mind. It has a certain primality to it, which is not the consequence of anything, cannot be confounded or bounded by measure.
No, all that's after the fact.
Yeah. That's the mortar of delusion. Measure and comparison is the mortar of delusion. It's very strange for us to be conversant, hanging out, not introvertedly sitting on a cushion in a darkened hall, and peer right into the nature of measureless infinity, border-free, reference-free infinity.
That's great fun.
You know, the model that we've all been, let's say, exposed to of someone at the dais or the front of the hall or walking beautifully with flowing robes through the ashram garden is so 2013. You know, by now, as mature adults, having given, right, a tremendous amount of attention and affection a tremendous amount of interest and sincerity to the question of realization or the question of awake. Well, why can't we hang out as peers feeling this? And not go through the histrionics and the hysteria, you know, of the guru celebrity culture.
Well, sometimes it's hard to rest in the fact that this is inexhaustible. And so sometimes it feels easier to try to string together bubbles of inconceivability dynamically to see if some string might be more
sure.
meaningful to me than any other one.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I do that once in a while. They don't unstring and all of a sudden it's like, what, do I then just start up another one or do I all of a sudden just like check out of all that altogether?
If our so-called life comes to the forefront of our attention, our activity, our relationship, our, you know, experience in the business world, okay, you know, let it. There's no point in trying to deny that our attention is being occupied by what we call our lives. No biggie. It's not like we've ever lost sight or lost our confidence. In this quietude.
Yeah, like, I mean, the words Peter uses is that regardless of all that stuff, this never departs from being itself, so it doesn't matter.
Sure.
Hey, look, I got to get ready for work, but it's been a pleasure hanging out with all you folks, and thanks for hosting, Jeff.
Thanks for cooking for us earlier and your kind presence.
Yeah, and yours. Uh-huh. So everyone have whatever goodness is left over to have. All right, I'll shut up. See you later. Okay. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye, John.
It's a little after 9. We kind of got started a little late. I'm happy to close the call down and respect everyone's privacy, or we can go a little longer if you got nothing better to do.
Open for a little bit. I have to go soon, but not just yet.
Okay. I'm good for a little more bliss.
I never have anything else to do, so.
We can always depend on Francine.
For having nothing better to do.
That's what it comes to, huh? That's what it's come to.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yep.
That's what it always comes to, I think.
Yeah.
Good generalization.
When there's nothing better to do, you're there.
Do it.
Do it. Do that. Do whatever it is you're doing when there's nothing better to do than that.
There's more often encounters of nothing better to do. So, you know, you find that, I find that's often the case anyways. You know, that's not something that I would rather do. It's not that same level of interest that I might have had. I still like one of the movies.
No, the yoga, past, present, and future, whether it's Patanjali or Iyengar or anywhere along the line, all of the yogas have simply encouraged or invited us, the aspirants, to rest. Take rest. Take refuge in the miracle of one's own subjective nature. Without identity, without particularization. The meditations were never intended to be grueling. It's like the Zen culture of grueling against the wall meditation in the midst of the stress of working on a koan is just some Japanese guy's idea of a bad joke. And similarly, in the Guenka, you know, the militaristic Vipassana tradition of sitting through searing, burning, physical, emotive, and psychological pain is just some other jerk's idea of a bad joke. Resting in yourself is absolutely nonviolent. Do this has nothing to prove. That's the yoga.
The lazy man's way.
Yeah. You know, if we have what's called in the 12-step room a burning desire, you know, then of course we conduct ourselves as best we can to quelling the fire of a burning desire. But our true aim is just here, just now, just this. No violence. If the prana field that stimulates the neocortex goes into a natural abeyance, then no identity is created. That this is so does not convey, demand, insist upon a disparate identity. You know, even a clown can do this.
What?
If a clown can do this, we ought to be able to.
It is a clown that's been around the block, though.
I have one, too.
I don't have a clown. I would get one if I did. I got Fred. He looks like a clown.
Fred does look like a clown. Wonderful to discover one's dignity without accomplishment, without letters, without attainment.
Clown.
Hopefully another clown. Out on a couch. See what's seductive when we talk about realization as a, you know, a certain kind of refinement or a certain kind of perfection in consciousness. It creates that right kind of a pressure of time, space, and becoming. And it's quite the other way. It's kind of counterintuitive that having no interest in an idealized condition that one might imagine as enlightenment is better, more successful than scratching and pining and studying, efforting to fulfill an idealized identity. Your own dignity is profound beyond measure. And that whole, you know, carrot on the stick called permanent enlightenment for the likes of me becomes trivial.